Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. I hope you enjoyed our guest last week, Yvonne Smith, a clinical hypnotherapist who is actually one of the leading researchers of UFO abductions. She sure had a lot of information to share, and wow, it was very educational and quite enlightening. If you didn't get a chance to catch the show, all the shows are put on the archives on the BBS website, so you can always look it up when you have a chance. Anyway, we're moving in a little bit of a different direction tonight. Some people might not call this strictly paranormal, but it's certainly a mystery about what we're talking tonight, which is the monuments of ancient Egypt, and specifically a new book by one of the leaders in this field of Egyptology and ancient archaeology is Robert Bauval, B-A-U-V-A-L, and he's written this amazing new book, which is called The Egypt Code. Now, this is a really interesting book because actually he's written a couple of other books. The Orion Mystery, and which was about the star correlation theory of the Giza pyramids in Egypt, which we'll talk some about, and another book, Keeper of the Genesis, which was also a bestseller, and these were translated into multiple languages. So this guy is really quite an expert. Now tonight we're going to be talking not only about this pyramid star correlation, but also what appears to be a grand unified plan, which involves the extraordinary temples of Upper Egypt. And I don't know if you people out there know a lot about Egypt, but even the Greeks and the Romans were mystified by them, and it's been a great mystery for many, many years. But there's a lot of been written about it throughout the years, and much of what has been written explains how Egypt has been sort of made in the image of heaven. So it's very interesting. Is there an astronomical alignment to these monuments, and what does it mean, and why were they made that way? This is some of the things we're going to be talking about tonight with our guest, Robert Bauval. He is a construction engineer, and his interest in Egyptology is very longstanding. He's lived in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East for much of his life, and in the 1980s, he developed a line of study linking the pyramid texts with astronomy, and this star correlation theory, which sent a huge shockwave of controversy, actually, throughout the scientific community, and the effects of which are still being felt today. So we're very, very honored to have him on to the show tonight. Thank you, Robert, for coming on to the show.
Hi, Preston. It's a pleasure.
So, all the way from Spain. What time is it there now?
It's just past 4 a.m.
Oh,
and,
wow.
The sun will rise in about 4 hours' time. So I've got a cup of coffee next to me, and I've went to bed early, so I'm sharp and ready for your questions.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come onto the show.
Yeah, I have an interview at 6 a.m. as well, so I'll be staying up the rest of the night.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not surprised because this book is pretty, you know, well, like your other books, got a lot of amazing information and just sort of very cutting edge, I guess you would say. So I'm really excited to talk with you tonight. I did have a gentleman on the show last year, I think, who also was an Egyptologist, and he had studied a lot of these texts and found what appears to be some UFO sightings. A lot of speculation about, you know, why these monuments were built. So let's just get into it. I mean, have you always been interested in this subject?
Although it really kicked off for me in the early 80s, as you rightly said, I was born in Egypt and grew up there. I left Egypt when I was 19. So like most most people who live there, you're bound to come across the pyramids sooner or later. Although I lived in the city of Alexandria, which is 200 kilometers away, but I saw the pyramids as a young child, and to me they immediately hit me and became very very keen on anything to do with them. But it wasn't my profession. Egyptology, in fact, isn't my profession. I'm a construction engineer, and I was minding my own business, as it was, doing construction engineering for a long time, until I found myself in Saudi Arabia, and this is where it all started for me, because I took an interest in the layouts of the pyramids while I was living in Saudi Arabia, for a simple reason. I think, although I've told this story umpteen times, I think for your listeners who are new to this, I think it's worth knowing how it came about, because I think it gives the message to anyone who is pursuing an idea that sometimes you know, against all odds, things come and materialize. But in any case, I mean, with me, it started with a photograph. I happened to be working in the city of Riyadh in 1983, and I decided to take a trip to Egypt. By the way, Preston, you'll have to sort of cough a bit or make a bit of noise, but I know you're still there, because sometimes the line cuts.
I'm here. I'm listening.
Now, I've given many interviews this month, and occasionally the line cuts, so if you stop hearing me... okay, anyway. So... I went to Egypt to visit my mother, who was still living in Egypt in the early 80s, and I decided to go and visit the Cairo Museum. And to cut a long story short, because I'm sure we don't have much time for all this, but I saw a photograph, an aerial photograph of the pyramids of Giza, the famous right. pyramids of Giza. And in those days, long before Google Earth and the Internet, such photographs were not common to see. I mean, it was the first time that I actually saw an overhead picture. And it struck me immediately that what I was looking at was what is known in engineering as an anomalistic plan. What it means is that I was looking at a plan, but it didn't make sense. There was two very large pyramids that seemed to be aligned along their diagonal. They seemed to be related to each other, but there was a third pyramid, a smaller pyramid, that was offset from this this alignment.
Right. Well, you have a photograph of this in the book, which you can clearly see.
That's right. And can your viewers, listeners, see you as well?
No.
Oh, I thought you could go on the net and okay, anyway, well, there you are. You're seeing it at least, and this image stuck in my mind, and I decided to find out why this plan was this way. And I had no idea about the pyramid text. Now, the pyramid texts are written, or carved rather, in pyramids of the 5th and 6th dynasty. This is about 2300 BC, and these pyramid texts are immediately after the construction of the Great Pyramids of Giza, okay. which we allocate to the 4th dynasty, roughly about 2500 BC. Now, one of the mysterious things about the pyramids, apart from many other things which we will discuss, is that they do not contain any inscriptions. These pyramids of Giza are totally devoid of contemporary inscriptions. But in contrast, we have all these 5th and 6th dynasty pyramids which are full of these texts. And these texts speak of the king resurrection or rebirth, and mainly they expound a sky religion where the king becomes a star and somehow is sent to a region of the sky where the constellation of Orion is located. Now, the constellation of Orion is a kind of huge rectangle It can be seen at dawn, by the way, before sunrise at this time of year, for those who are awake at that time of day and want to have a glimpse. It's a kind of huge rectangle formed by four stars, and at the middle of this rectangle are three bright stars. And on one particular evening, I happened to be in the desert with a friend of mine who was a navigator, and he pointed to the stars of Orion, or Orion's belt, these three stars at the center, and explained to me that you could use them to extend a line backwards, so you could find the star Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky, which incidentally was the star of rebirth of the ancient Egyptians. Again, I'll talk about that in a bit later. So there we were looking at these three stars of Orion's belt, and suddenly he said in an afterthought, they're not quite in a row. The two brightest stars are aligned, but the smaller one is offset. And what I saw, I mean, what clicked in my mind was the image of the three pyramids on the ground in relation to the three stars in Orion's belt. Now, what clinched it for me was that not only we had the pyramid text that confirmed this stellar destination of the pyramid builders, but also that there was inside the Great Pyramid, the largest of the pyramids of Giza, a shaft, a kind of narrow shaft that shot out from the king's chamber upwards. And we knew since the early 60s that this shaft had pointed to the three stars of Orion's belt. So there you are. This became known as the Orion correlation theory. And I published it in the late 80s. And I wrote a book called The Orion Mystery in 1994, and then hell broke loose because it literally hit the small screen. It was a major documentary by the BBC in England in 94. And it's been debated ever since. So the rest is history.
Why do you suppose they built these pyramids to in alignment with Orion's belt?
Ah, well, that's the big question, and I'm glad you asked it this way, because it simplifies the whole motive of these ancient people who built pyramids. Indeed, why would they build monuments aligned to stars? I mean, and correlated them to stars. I mean,
there's so many different stars too.
let me say this, because I was just writing a small article just before you called. I'm doing a monograph for a very popular magazine in Italy, and it's all about Egypt. So I was just writing what I'm about to tell you. Imagine a pyramid. There are several pyramid complexes in the region where modern Cairo is. Today, about 25 of these royal pyramids, or these great pyramids, have survived. Of course, the most popular and the greatest are the ones at Giza. But there are about 25 of them in clusters, sprawling over an area of about 60 kilometers. If you can imagine one of these clusters, let's take the pyramids of Giza. And here is how I describe them in our modern terms.
Right.
They have a function. They obviously had a function. They weren't built just for decoration. And if you can correlate them to a computer, then the hardware of this computer is the pyramid itself, the pyramid complex, the hard stone, if you like. The processor is the machinery of the sky, the cycles of the sky that goes above it. And I'll get into that a bit later in the interview. But so here we have a motion, something moving, which is the celestial cycles, the rising of the sun, the rising of the stars, and as they perpetually move above this stone complex. The software are the rituals performed by the people within that complex. And the output, the motive, if you like, the whole purpose of this, was the rebirth resurrection of the king and his ascent to the stellar world. So that's how you have to see them. They're a kind of spiritual machine, if you like, a rebirth machine. And that's the purpose of them. I coined the phrase, by the way, in my second book, which I wrote with Graham Hancock, a very popular author in this research,
right.
Called The Message of the Sphinx. And there I coined a phrase which has become rather popular in this field of research, which is the science of immortality. It looks like the ancient Egyptians believed that they had found a science of immortality, that they could actually convert a dead corpse into a spiritual being. And it doesn't matter whether you believe in this or not, but they certainly believed it, and the pyramids are the expression and the attempts, and they're part of the machinery required for this science. So that's how one has to see them. But of course, there are many, many other ways of looking at these monuments. And as you were saying earlier, I mean, there's all sorts of theories related to them. But I believe that this is what it's all about. And this is exactly the context that we are dealing with. We're dealing with an ancient people. Now, of course, I want to bring this up immediately. There's a huge debate as to how ancient we're talking about. The Egyptologists fix the beginning of Egyptian civilization at about 3000 BC, and the pyramids that we've just been talking about are dated to about 2500 BC. It's pretty old already, but there's much indication that we're dealing with a far, far older culture. And that's the mystery of all these monuments, is that the origins of this culture is a big question mark. We're not quite sure where they came from, who were they, and how come suddenly pyramids began to be built all over the place as if coming from nowhere.
Well, what is the evidence that their civilization is older than popular theory?
Well, the first clues that came out were in the early 90s, first by two Americans, a researcher called John Anthony West, and a professor of geology at Boston University called Robert Schock. They're both very, very good friends of mine. And at that time, John West had been arguing that the erosion on the body of the Sphinx. Now, the Sphinx is a huge lion-bodied statue with a head of a human being, the head of probably a pharaoh. And it is, for those who haven't seen it in Egypt, but have seen photographs of it, it is not a built monument. It's actually carved from the living rock. And it's carved in a sort of horseshoe pit. And the walls of this pit, or this enclosure, it's very, very obvious when you're there on location, that the walls are sliced vertically by these vertical cuts. And it was very obvious that it must have been water that caused this erosion. And John West went about trying to argue that the erosion that he was seeing was not visible anywhere else in the area. It just happened to be there. And it couldn't have been rain, because it couldn't just have rained over the Sphinx and not anywhere else in the region. So the water must have come from somewhere. And he argued that it must have come at a time when there was a lot of water in the area. And indeed there was. So he got Robert Schock, the geologist, involved, and they came up, after investigating the erosion on the stone and the climatic conditions, they came up with the conclusion that the monument, the Sphinx, must have been there a long, long time before the pyramids were built, before the date that was allocated to this place, before 2500 BC. And they came up with a date roughly between 7000 and 15000 BC. That caused a huge, huge reaction in the academic world, because, of course, here you had a Boston emeritus professor putting his whole reputation on this conclusion. You still there, Preston?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I'll be checking once in a while. I'll tell you why. I once talked for about 20 minutes, and I realized the line was cut. So, okay, now come in the picture, Graham Hancock and myself, when we wrote the message of the Sphinx, because here we were coming with another hard science. We were using astronomy to try and understand the layout of the Giza pyramids in relation to the Sphinx. And to cut a long story short, I'm not going to go into the scientific jargon of all this, but our conclusion was that the whole Giza necropolis, in other words, the pyramids and the Sphinx together, was a kind of three-dimensional image, if you like, a sort of holographic image of the sky region between the constellation of Orion and the constellation of Leo, the lion. And not only that, but the perfect ground-to-sky correlation occurred in the 11th millennium BC. So here we had two hard sciences, the geology by Schock and West, and the astronomy by Hancock and myself, that argued for a much, much older civilization. Of course, this was a kind of anathema to the academics, and there's been many, many debates since then. However, one of the arguments against this was, well, where is the evidence? You know, where is the hard evidence? I mean, where is that culture? Where are they? I mean, and this was the problem. But recently, there's been very hard evidence that confirms that there was, in that region, a very, very old culture that hasn't been detected so far. And I hope, if you tell me 10 minutes before we close this interview, I'll be talking about these new discoveries, which is going to be the subject of a book that I'm writing with an American author, a fellow called Thomas Brophy, who is an astrophysicist.
Wow.
The book is going to be called Black Genesis, and it will become obvious why we chose this title, because the origins of the Egyptian civilization is almost certainly a black origin, an origin from Central Africa, of a culture that so far we haven't detected, and they've only become apparent to us in the last few years.
Well, in regards to this Egyptian culture, I mean, here's a culture that lived, geez, this long ago, however long ago it is, and they have the ability to build these monuments in such exact correlation to so many of these stars. And, I mean, how did they do it? What do we know about this culture? How advanced were they?
Well, you know, as I'm sitting here in Spain, about a block away lives my brother, who is about 8 years older than I. We're both retired, by the way. I'm 61, although I'm still writing. He's an architect, and I'm a construction engineer. And as you can imagine, we've discussed... We've discussed the construction of these monuments over the last 20 years, and we still do. Every time we meet in a coffee bar, we talk about this. And I can tell you, I mean, I've been involved with these monuments for the last 25 years, and I have conversed with some of the very, very top architects, engineers, structural engineers, stone masons. I've talked to all of them. I've even had very, very close relationship with some of the very, very top Egyptologists in this field. The late Professor Edwards was a good acquaintance of mine, and we've had endless discussions about these monuments. And I can tell you this, no one has figured out exactly how they were built. In the context that we are told by Egyptologists, I mean, the context that we're given is 2500 BC, at a time when the wheel wasn't yet invented, at a time when there was no iron tools, no machines, basically just hard labor and sticks and ropes. So it's very, very hard to imagine how they were able to raise structures of this size. and with this kind of precision, because the pyramids are not just huge monuments. I have just come from Cairo. I was living there for the last 3 years with my wife, literally opposite the Giza Necropolis. From our balcony, you could almost touch the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
And, I've seen this monument for you know, that close for a long, long time. And I can tell you, they're awesome. I mean, the Great Pyramid is 146 meters high. It has a mass of about 6 million tons. It contains something like 2.5 million blocks. But that's not just that is impressive. What is impressive is the perfect alignments, the absolute precision that the Great Pyramid is aligned to the cardinal directions. It's within 5% of a single degree accuracy. It's the kind of high tech of the ancient world. You know, it's sort of, I call it the Swiss watch of the ancient world. And it's very, very hard to imagine how primitive people with no special tools, with no optical instruments, could achieve that kind of precision and that kind of size in that period of time. So I'm still baffled. I mean, I think we're all baffled because the context that we are given by Egyptologists simply doesn't fit what we see. And therefore, either we're looking at a culture that has been highly misunderstood, that they were much more advanced than we thought, or we're looking at something else. And this something else, of course, has drawn a lot of people to devise all sorts of theories.
Well, I think the logical conclusion would be that they were more advanced. I mean, it seems to be
think. I think that... Sorry, I've interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing. I think that's the easiest theory that to fall upon. I mean, when most...
if things don't fit, then it means the model that we are using is wrong. Science is often based on models. You know, we had the flat Earth model, and when Copernicus and Galileo said it didn't fit, you know. And there's something that doesn't fit with what you see at Giza. And let me tell you that perhaps the most impressive of the structures that we see there are not the pyramids. The pyramids are huge and very precise and mind-blowing, but there is something else there that is very, very intriguing, and these are what we call the mortuary and valley temples that are attached to the pyramids. Now, each pyramid has what we call a mortuary temple. Whether it was a mortuary temple or not, we don't know, but that's what Egyptologists call them, attached to the eastern face of each pyramid. And there is another temple further down towards the Nile, which they call the Valley Temple. And the two temples are linked by a causeway. These causeways are still visible there today. And even these temples, much of them remains for us to investigate. Now, here is the weird thing about these temples. The blocks that they used range between 50 and 200 tons. Now, Just to give you an idea, a 200-ton block is the size of, well, I'm looking at my sitting room. It's about the size of a large sitting room. It would require something like 300 men minimum to be able to sort of slide it a bit on the ground, if that was possible at all, let alone raise these blocks to 10, 15 meters of heights, which we see today. So to me, this is baffling, how they could use blocks of this size and move them around. And the question, of course, is why? Why would they bother? Because to build a temple, one could easily do it with much smaller blocks, blocks that were more manageable and easy to move around. So why would they do this? And nobody has come up with any answers. I mean, no matter how many engineers and architects you put on the job, nobody can explain it. So clearly we're looking at a culture that had understood how to move blocks of this size and seemed to have found it very easy because there's a lot of these blocks about. So this is the mystery of this place, is that not only this is what we see, but most annoyingly, most maddening, they haven't left us any inscriptions to tell us how and why they were doing this. And to me, this is the greatest mystery. Why wouldn't they tell us? And maybe they are telling us. That's what I've been saying for the last 20 years. They're telling us, but not in the way that we think they're telling us. In other words, they're not writing about it. They have expressed themselves in a mathematical language, in an astronomical language that is universal. And this is really what I've been advocating for many, many years, is that we must read these monuments from a completely different perspective.
So it's their correlation to each other and all of this, they're almost like it's a different language practice.
That's right. And this is, of course, the intriguing aspect of these monuments, is that the language that they express themselves, mathematics, geometry, astronomy, high precision astronomy, is universal. That means that you and I can understand it, and anybody, anywhere in this universe can understand it. So it's very intriguing why and they use this language. It's as if they wanted to express themselves in a manner that would be understood no matter what alphabet and what language you spoke, that you would use what we call the universal constants and the universal language of mathematics and astronomy.
Well, so I'm beginning to get the picture of these guys. I mean, if they're this good at building things and they're that advanced in astronomy and they're using this mathematical language, clearly they were a very scientific culture.
No doubt about it. I mean, there is absolutely no doubt about it. And this is the huge conflict that exists between the so-called alternative historians. I'm called an alternative Egyptologist. It's a kind of almost an insult these days when it comes to academia. And the orthodox Egyptologists, we conflict on this point, because what the alternative Egyptologists are saying is that we are looking at something that is far more sophisticated, far more advanced, that needs to be explained. Whereas the explanation given by the orthodoxy, by the academics, is so prosaic that it doesn't fit what we see. They want to see them as tombs. They want to see them as a bunch of superstitious people building monuments for the ego trip of their pharaohs, and it doesn't make sense. So this is the huge conflict.
I think there, another thing that points to them being advanced is just the sheer beauty of these monuments. I mean, the artistic quality of some of the statues, and I mean, it's amazing.
Absolutely. Let me tell you something else about the Great Pyramid, is that one of the mystifying things which has been picked up from very early days, I mean, 200 years ago when a scientist began to look at this monument in a more scientific manner, what immediately was picked up is that the height of the pyramid in relation to its base, the base is a square, it squats on the ground like a huge block, if you like,
right.
And this square in relation to the height represents a circle. That means the height is the radius of the base, if the base was a circle. This is known as squaring the circle. In other words, that they seem to have wanted this pyramid to be seen not as a square-based pyramid, but as a sort of cone where the base was a circle. And this is very, very intriguing, because one of the things that points to a deliberate choice of design here to imply circle is because of the cardinality of the monument. They seem to have designed a huge waypoint, a sort of giant GPS point, if you like,
right,
which is there not only aligned to the cardinal directions, but in a specific location on the Earth. It is, by the way, almost precisely on latitude 30. Now, again, to cut the science and the jargon here, but if you put something at latitude 30, you're going to get, and especially a monument of this kind of design, with this kind of proportions, what you're going to get is what we call beautiful angles in geometry with the sky. So you're going to get angles of 40... Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. You're going to get angles of 45 degrees, of 30 degrees, of 60 degrees, and 90 degrees. These are the Pythagorean angles, if you like, the angles that that architects would use to design monuments and that artists use to design shapes. You know, these are the beautiful angles. And this is what you get when you analyze the monument. You realize that you have a gigantic waypoint, a gigantic compass, if you like, that marks a position on the Earth. It's also, incidentally, in the precise center of the Earth's land masses. That means if you would bring all the five continents together in one gigantic mass, the Great Pyramid would be located right at the center of this mass. So
wow.
There's too much coincidence here. We're looking at people who were aware of where they were on the globe, and they were very much aware of how the globe related to the celestial cycles.
That's amazing. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight is Robert Bovall, and we're talking about his new book, The Egypt Code. It's very, very exciting. It's all about the mysteries of Egypt and what it means. Now, Robert, what exactly is the Egypt Code, and why'd you call your book? Why'd you give it that title?
Right. Well, one thing we know for sure about the ancient Egyptians of that period, or incidentally, of every period. Now, as far as Egyptologists are concerned, the Egyptian civilization started in 3000 BC and extinguished itself when the Romans came in about 30 BC. So we have almost 3000 years of Egyptian pharaonic civilization. I believe it's much older, but even if you accept that frame time given by the Egyptologists, we have 3,000 years of Egyptian civilization where they built monuments from the very early stage. These are the pyramids. And then they started building various other monuments, temples, tombs, all over the what we call the Nile Valley. Now, Egypt is a kind of elongated land running from north, where the Mediterranean is,
right,
all the way to the Sudanese borders, which is in the distant south, for about almost 1,000 kilometers. And basically, it is a valley, a river valley, a narrow strip of land flanked by deserts. And so what we have here is monuments that are laid out from the north to the south, all over that Nile Valley, all along that Nile Valley, over 3,000 years period. Now, having established this, this is what, if you can imagine flying over Egypt and seeing all these monuments along the Nile, you would see them all at once, from a satellite perspective. However, they were not built all at once. They were built over 3,000 years. So if you could sort of time-lapse the 3,000 years, you would see pyramids springing all over the place in the northern part of Egypt, and then gradually these temples sprouting out of the lands all the way to the south.
Right.
Having said this, one of the things that we know about these pharaohs is that they were obliged by oath. When a pharaoh ascended to the throne, he took an oath, very much like the president of the United States, whoever he's going to be, by the way, is going to take an oath on the Bible about his commitment to the nation. What the pharaohs would do is they actually would take an oath, and one of the aspects of this oath was that they would adhere to and control and ensure the cosmic order. Now, what do they mean by this? Is that the pharaoh was responsible for regulating the events that happened in the sky and those that happened on the ground. Now, this is what they believe the pharaoh's job was, to regulate the world. A bit like the president in the White House, who is going to regulate the world, but with different means.
Right.
So the pharaoh was the controller of the universe, if you like. And what was he controlling? So from what we read in the text, it seems that he was given the responsibility to ensure that the machinery of the sky, the cycles of the sky, were in harmony with the events on the ground, a sort of giant astrology, if you like. And the reason they believe this is that they had very early established that what happened in the sky, the rising of the sun, the changing position of the sun through the year, the rising of the stars and their changing time through the year, seemed to correlate to what was happening on the ground, because they had a very, very distinctive cycle, which was the cycle of the Nile. The Nile would flood every year around the time of the summer solstice, around the end of June. The waters would rise and flood the land and irrigate the land, the whole Nile Valley, and regenerate Egypt. It was like an automatic irrigation machine, if you like.
Wow.
And this had been going on for yonks, for time immemorial. What made it very mysterious is that first they didn't know the origins of the Nile. They didn't know where the water came from. And more mystifying was that the Nile would begin to rise and flood the land when it was the hottest time of the year, at the summer solstice. It didn't make sense to them. I mean, it totally mystified them. When they expected the Nile waters to drop, they in fact swelled and flooded the land. So this became the great mystery of this land. What caused this? And what they began to realize was that the Nile was beginning to flood when the sun was at a certain position at the summer solstice, at its highest position in the sky at noon, and when certain stars would appear at dawn after having disappeared from the sky for a long period of time. They would rise just before dawn, as they do now, by the way, at this time of year. And the stars that I'm talking about are the stars of Orion and the star Sirius. So you can see why these stars began to be very, very important to them, because they believed that it was these stars and the position of the sun at the summer solstice that caused the Nile to flood. And they correlated both. They imagined that this... Now, their biggest worry was that the Nile waters, the flood waters, would not come. And therefore, they devised rituals, if you like. They devised a kind of software to ensure that the Nile waters would come when these stars would appear and when the sun would be at summer solstice. So here you have the rituals. They would perform these rituals. The king would be responsible for these rituals to ensure, in their way of thinking, that the Nile waters would come. Because if it didn't come, disaster would strike Egypt. There would be famine. There would be total calamities. And we know that this happened once in a while. We have records of the Nile flood not coming or not rising enough to irrigate the land. And we had a famine. And probably the famine of the Bible that speaks of this great famine in Egypt was probably caused by a bad Nile, a Nile that did not behave in the manner that it was supposed to. And therefore the king was responsible for ensuring this. So this is how they regulated the land. And they devised a kind of machine, if you like. And the pyramids are part of this machine. And of course the king would die. And the king was replaced by another king. And they believed that there was a perpetual motion machine, like in the sky, that the king was constantly being replaced, that he was regenerated, that he was reborn in the form of another king, and on it went. So, in other words, Egypt was eternally connected to the machine of the sky. Now, are you still there, Preston?
I am. I'm listening intently.
All right. Well, having understood this machine, I'm one of the very few people who understands it. I mean, not to blow my trumpet, but I've been immersed in this kind of research for a long, long time. And the Egypt Code, by the way, tries to put it in layman terms. I mean, so when you read the Egypt Code, hopefully you understand how this this machine worked in the minds of the ancient Egyptians. I mean, that's how they perceived their land and their monuments. Now, having said this, what would happen in the sky was that the position of the sun in relation to the calendar and the position of the stars in relation to the astronomical cycles would change. And the reason they would change was because of a phenomena we call the precession of the equinoxes. Now, again, to cut the jargon away from all this, the Earth has three motions. Everybody knows at least two. It rotates on its axis and we get night and day.
Right.
And then it revolves around the sun and we get the seasons. But it also slowly gyrates in a very, very slow cycle of 26,000 years, kind of like a spinning top moving extremely slowly. And this we call the precession of the equinoxes, and this causes the stars, the constellation, to change position and to also change the time of rising. So in other words, the celestial order, the machinery of the sky, changed with time. And if the theory is correct, if they were really following this, then we would expect to see the changes on the ground. And we have 3,000 years of time here to examine. And this is what I've done in the Egypt Code. I've looked very, very carefully at the position of monuments all along the Nile Valley throughout these 3,000 years of civilization. And what I show in the book is that they actually were following the changes in the sky. So we have a kind of civilization that locked itself to the machinery of the sky and changed progressively. And this explains why they moved monuments from north to south, and they even changed their cities from north to south in time frames that match the events in the sky. And this is what the Egypt Code brings on the table. It shows how the ancient Egyptians not only perceived the land as a cosmic land, but they actually locked it into the machinery of the sky. And this is, to me, a very exciting thing, because it provides us with a people that thought in cosmic terms, that they saw themselves not part of a country,
right,
but part of a cosmos. And this is, to me, very, very important, because this is the way we really should see ourselves. You know, we have changed this way of thinking, and we have separated the Earth into portions, and we call them countries, and we've been fighting over these pieces of Earth for the last 2,000 years. But we have one Earth, we have one cosmos, and we are inhabitants of that cosmos. And that's how the ancient Egyptians saw themselves. And it's a way of thinking that perhaps need to be reestablished, because it provides a truly global way of thinking, and the ancient Egyptians understood this.
Right. Well, what happened to the ancient Egyptians? I mean, their civilization apparently lasted a long time to be able to build all these monuments and record them and correlate them. And I mean, do we know what happened to them?
Oh yeah, we do. And the terrible thing that happened to the world civilization was that we would probably still be all ancient Egyptians or new modern Egyptians, if you like, had they not been invaded by the Romans. I mean, the Romans developed a different system of thinking, where it was all based on pure, brutal physical force to overpower and control the world.
Wow.
And a completely different vision than the ancient Egyptians. And when they came over to Egypt, they simply took over and slowly eradicated this ancient culture. So we're in a sense the product of the Roman takeover, if you like, which has completely eradicated a spiritual way of thinking into a power way of thinking, and we've been kind of confused, if you like, over the last 2,000 years. You know, whether we like it or not, it depends what kind of person you are. I mean, you can be a dry atheist and say, you know, life is meaningless and we're just a lump of flesh.
Right.
Or you can be that other kind of person that does not deny that we are made of body and spirit. And I'm one of those people. I mean, you know, as much as one wants to be cool and stay scientific, we all feel that we are made of both body and spirit. And the ancient Egyptians focused on the spiritual aspect of our existence, which is ultimately the important one. And their land and their whole culture and their whole social way of behaving was directed towards this spiritual way of thinking. Whereas we have abandoned this. We're kind of people with amnesia. You know, this is a phrase coined by my colleague Graham Hancock. We're a people with amnesia. We forgot who we really are, and this is very important that we reestablish this way of thinking. This is why it's, to me, studying ancient Egypt isn't just studying ancient monuments and artifacts and writing historical books about it. It is to rediscover a culture that had somehow understood the true purpose of our existence on this planet, that there is a mission that involves all of us, and this mission is to attain spiritual enlightenment, to bring ourselves to a way of thinking and to link up with the eternal aspects of the cosmos. This is what we should be focusing on, rather than the stock market, by the way.
Right. Well, I think that's what's one of the reasons why your books are so popular, and I think people are really craving the kind of information you're giving out, and you know, your excitement about the subject really shows through in your writing and in your book.
Thank you.
It's really, you know, pretty gripping and filled with information. I love the pictures too, the photographs.
You know, I haven't yet seen the American edition, so you're telling me about it, but I haven't seen it.
I think it's a great book. You've done an excellent job. But you know, we're almost out of time. I mean, we have a few minutes to wrap it up.
Yep.
I just wanted to ask you if you had any last things you wanted to say that you think people should know about.
Yes, I do. I mean, very, very briefly, I want to say that recent discoveries in the Egyptian Sahara have confirmed that there was a prehistoric culture that probably dates from thousands of years before the pharaohs. This is a fact. I mean, I'm not theorizing here. There was a culture when the Sahara was fertile, and we know that the Sahara was green thousands of years before the pharaohs. And we have found now evidence of this culture all over the place, all over the Sahara. I've just been on a huge expedition in April in the depths of the Egyptian Sahara. And what we're finding there is amazing stuff. Monuments that resemble mini Stonehenges in the desert, aligned to the constellations, aligned to the rising sun. And evidence, literally photographic evidence of this culture. They left us drawings in caves in an area in the extreme southwest of Egypt and of themselves. And what we're seeing is tall, slender, amazing people who were obviously black and who were there for thousands and thousands of years and who had understood all the basis of what we call civilization. They had astronomy, they had mathematics, they began building monuments, structures, they aligned them to the constellations, and they were able to navigate. They were able to move in vast regions of the desert with high precision. And it is almost certainly those people that when the desert became arid, went to the Nile Valley and kick-started the pharaonic civilization. I'm writing a book about this called The Black Genesis with Thomas Brophy, the astrophysicist. It will be out in a year, and we've just been commissioned by an American publisher, and we're about to start writing it in the next few weeks. So, you know, get ready, folks. We're going to put the world upside down here, literally. We have the completely wrong idea of who we are, where we came from, and where we're going. And we hope that we'll provide some of the answers.
Well, that's pretty exciting stuff. Well, thank you, Robert, for coming onto the show. It's been amazing.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Preston. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I like your style. I like your style. You left me left me give my spiel. You're a good listener.
Oh, it's very, very interesting stuff, man.
Thank you.
You're really doing some amazing pioneering work, and it shows in your writing.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm definitely going to have to pick up that next book and have you back on the show when that comes out.
Thank you. Yes, I look forward to it.
All right, everyone. Well, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank you all for listening. Our guest tonight has been Robert Bovall, B-A-U-V-A-L, Robert Bovall, who has written an incredible new book, actually, called The Egypt Code. So if you have any interest in this subject at all, this is the guy, this is the book you're going to want to read. He's the leading expert. So I hope you all enjoyed the show as much as I have. It's been amazing. I hope you can join us next week when I bring on another exciting guest to talk about UFOs and the paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. Hope you can join us next week. Until then, have a great night and an exciting week. Bye now.